us, that our eyes may run with tears and our eyelids gush with water. For a voice of wailing is heard from Zion. How we are plundered. We are greatly ashamed because we have forsaken the land, because we have been cast out of our dwelling. Yet hear the word of the Lord, O women, meaning these wailing women, and let your ear receive the word of his mouth. Teach your daughters wailing, and everyone her neighbor a lamentation. For death has come through our windows, has entered our palaces to kill off the children, no longer to be outside, and the young men no longer in the streets. In other words, after the desolation of the war, you won't be able to see children playing outside anymore, or men, young men in the streets. There just won't be any of them left. Speak thus, says the Lord, even the carcasses of men shall fall as refuse on the open field, like the cuttings after the harvester, and no one shall gather them. They'll just rot in the streets rather than being buried like cuttings that are cut down but never harvested, never gathered up. And then here's a classic passage. Thus says the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches. But let him who glories glory in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord, exercising loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, says the Lord. Now, wisdom, might, which means power, probably military power, and riches, the three things that people tend to glory in most, even to this day, in their physique, their muscles, or whatever, or in terms of governments, in their military power, that's might. Wisdom, people exult in their education or in their reputation for being wise, some of them do, and of course riches. Riches are a status symbol, and therefore it's very unusual to find a humble, rich person. These are the very things that people look to for self-importance and for reputation, the things they glory in. But Jeremiah is saying none of these things are really going to be able to save you, no matter how much money you have, no matter how much might you have, no matter how wise you are, you're all going down together. The only thing you really have, if you have it, that's worth anything and that you can glory in is that you have a relationship with God. Because if you do, you'll be delivered from the Holocaust that's coming. If you don't, your wisdom and your might and your riches are going to do you no good anyway. Don't glory in those things. But the one who wants to glory in something, let him glory in a relationship with God that he knows and understands me. Now, I find it interesting that he says knows and understands. It's obvious that you can understand or have academic knowledge about God or about anyone else for that matter and not know them. It's possible to be schooled in theology and not have a relationship at all with God, never have even had any contact with him. Just like it's possible to have the same kind of situation with another human being. You can read somebody's biography and know a great deal about them but never have met them and they don't even know you exist. And so because of this, it's been stressed maybe almost to a fault in our own time in some circles that theology isn't what's important. It's knowing God. Now that's half right. The half that's right is the second half. Knowing God is what's important. That's true. The first half is not right. Theology isn't important. But that is still a mentality that's very prevalent in some circles today. And perhaps the charismatic is where you find it most often today. Is because of experiential knowledge. The experiential orientation of charismatics that is so commonly they're criticized for is quite genuine. I mean, there really is such a problem in many charismatic circles, not all. And that experiential orientation, of course, places emphasis on experiential knowledge of God, hearing from God, hearing the voice of God today, and so forth. Now, those are, as far as I'm concerned, fine things. I've got no objection to those things. But then when you begin to talk about, let's talk about theology. There are some people who are averse to this. In fact, there's times when you hear apologies from the pulpit when a pastor says, well, we gotta tolerate a little theology for a few minutes here, you know. As if theology is something that needs to be tolerated or that is something to be ashamed of. God says the man that has something to exalt in is one who knows God and who understands him. Understanding God is what theology is about. Bad theology is misunderstanding about God. Good theology is right understanding about God. Theological questions are questions of how do we understand God? What do we understand His nature to be, His character to be? And if we have wrong notions, if we misunderstand the answers to these questions, then we have bad theology. Everybody's a theologian. It's just some are good theologians, some are bad theologians. Everybody has opinions about God, but not all understand Him. Some misunderstand Him. And Jesus Himself indicated that understanding is of tremendous importance. Jesus said that the seed that fell on the wayside and the birds ate it up are those who hear the word and don't understand. And therefore the devil comes and snatches it away. There needs to be experiential knowledge of God. There also needs to be an understanding of Him. That is, in the case of knowing and understanding God, would be theology. Having a correct theological notion about God. And so God says both are important. Perhaps a person with deficient theology can be forgiven if he at least has a good relationship with God. But anyone who has a good relationship with God will strive to have the best theology possible. If you value your relationship with any person, you'll want to get to know them as best you can, as accurately as you can. When you first meet somebody, you might have many first impressions that are mistaken. But if you really value a relationship with them, want to get to know them, you want those first impressions to be corrected if they're wrong. You want to find out what really makes them tick. You want to find out what really is important to them. You want to find out what kind of person they really are. And the same is true with knowing God. Knowing Him is essentially what matters. But getting to know and understand Him better is the path that we embark upon when we enter into a relationship with God. We seek to understand Him. And the thing that God says is particularly important for people to understand about Him in verse 24 is that I am the Lord, and that I exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. I'm a merciful God, but I'm also a judge. And I also don't compromise on right and wrong. I exercise righteousness in the earth. And I delight in these things. Anyone who understands that has got something to glory in. But the lack of that knowledge cannot be made up for by riches or might or wisdom in the human sense of those words. Verse 25. Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that I will punish all those who are circumcised with the uncircumcised. In other words, circumcision doesn't count for anything if you don't have a relationship with God as well. Egypt, Judah, Edom, the people of Ammon, Moab, and all who are in the farthest corners who dwell in the wilderness. Notice that list. They're all unclean, uncircumcised groups. Except for Judah, who is circumcised, but they're just thrown into the list. They're not at the beginning or the end of the list so as to set them apart. But they're just kind of one of the names on the list. Judah. The Jews. They're just kind of thrown in the middle of a list of unclean Gentile nations. You're saying there's really not much distinction, really. They're circumcised, the others aren't, but I'm going to judge them all. For all these nations are uncircumcised, and the house of Israel are uncircumcised in heart. So he's saying, he's going to judge, you know, Egypt and Edom and the people of Ammon and Moab because they're uncircumcised. But he's also going to judge the house of Israel or Judah because they too are uncircumcised in a sense. In the sense that matters, in their hearts. They have physical circumcision, it may be, but they don't have true circumcision. Now chapter 10 is a chapter that I think we can justly summarize a bit. It's basically a chapter, especially up through verse 16, about the stupidity of worshiping idols and the futility of trusting in idols. That is, that idols are nothing, but God is something. God sets Himself in contrast to the idols. For example, in verses 12 through 13, speaking of the true God, we'll start at verse 11. It talks about the false gods, and then it contrasts the false with the true. In verse 11, He says, "Thus you shall say to them, the gods that have not made the heavens and the earth shall perish from the earth and from under these heavens." Then speaking of God who has made the heavens and the earth, says, "He has made the earth by His power. He has established the world by His wisdom. He has stretched out the heavens at His discretion. When He utters His voice, there's a multitude of waters in the heavens," meaning He can bring rain by just speaking it. "And He causes the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He makes lightning for the rain, and He brings the wind out of the treasuries, out of His treasuries." Also, after saying how futile the idols are, for instance, in verse 15, he says, the idols are futile, the work of errors. In the time of punishment, they shall perish. But then speaking of God, the true God, verse 16, the portion of Jacob is not like them. For he is the maker of all things, and Israel is the tribe of his inheritance, and the Lord of hosts is his name. Now notice the big difference between God and the false gods that he stresses is that the true God made everything. He made the heavens and the earth. This gives him intrinsic authority over all things. He made it. He owns it. He controls it. He can destroy it if he doesn't like it. Later on in chapter 18, he compares the house of Israel with a potter's pot, and God is the potter. And in chapter 18, Jeremiah goes to a potter's house and he sees a potter working, and the pot he's working on is ruined on the wheel. And so the potter just discards it. And he says, can't I do whatever I want with you, Israel? I'm the clay, I'm the potter, you're the clay. I can do with you as I've done with this pot. I own you, I made you, you're mine. If I want, I can dump you. If you don't please me, I can destroy you. That's God's prerogative. Now the idols, who of course aren't even alive and haven't made a thing, don't have any authority or any power. And that is what Isaiah and Jeremiah and the other prophets frequently bring out, and what Jeremiah in this chapter is bringing out. The chapter opens, chapter 10, like this. Hear the word of the Lord, which the Lord speaks to you, O house of Israel. Thus says the Lord, do not learn the way of the Gentiles, which was the ways of idolatry. Do not be dismayed at the signs of the heaven. Astrology, don't concern yourself with it. For the Gentiles are dismayed at such things. For the customs of the peoples are futile. For one cuts a tree from the forest, the work of the hands of the workman with an axe. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with nails and hammers so that it will not topple. Yeah, right. Everyone sees this as a Christmas tree passage, you know. You go to the woods, you cut down a fir tree, you hang silver and gold on it, you fasten it up on a stand with nails, and they say, wow, man, God forbade the use of Christmas trees. But actually, the passage is not about Christmas trees, it's about idols. It's not talking about the use of fir trees. In fact, rather,
Christmas trees.
It's, huh?
Right, Christmas trees.
To some people, no doubt, Christmas trees are an idol. But I guess I've heard some teachers use this passage to suggest that the use of Christmas trees is of pagan origin, and it probably is, but that this passage was addressing that particular custom. Well, I believe that the use of Christmas trees is of pagan origins, but I don't think those pagan origins go back all the way to Jeremiah's time. I think they come from Roman times. Or maybe not. Maybe they're Babylonian origin. I don't really know all the facts about it. But it's clear that this passage is not talking about the precise custom of cutting down fir trees and decorating them in the house. It's talking about forming idols. They also were made from trees that were cut down. Notice it specifically in verse 3 says, the work of the hands of the workman. It's carved, it's shaped, it's worked to form something, to look like something. A Christmas tree is not. It is not compared to a fir tree, but a palm tree. In verse 5, it says, they're upright like the palm tree. They cannot speak, which is something that's also said of idols elsewhere. They must be carried because they cannot go by themselves. Now, these are what you're trusting in to save you? If your house is on fire, they can't even save themselves. You have to carry them out. They can't go by themselves. Do not be afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, nor can they do any good, for that matter. Inasmuch as there is none like you, O Lord, you are great. Your name is great in might. Who would not fear you, O King of the nations? So he says, don't fear the idols. They can't do you any harm. Come to think of it, they can't do you any good either. They can't do anything. They can't even move themselves from one place to another. Come think of it, it must be kind of dumb to worship those idols and trust in them, isn't it? That's what he's getting at. But however, God, now he's a real God. Who won't fear him? He is capable of doing both good and harm. And therefore, the appeal is to forsake the gods of the heathen, to pay no attention to their deities, which cannot avail, and to serve the true God. And there's much more poetic prophecy against idolatry up to that point. I want to move now to verse 17, though. Here, another prediction, down to verse 22, of the invasion, the Babylonians coming in and destroying. Gather up your wares from your land, O inhabitants of the fortress. For thus says the Lord, behold, I will throw out at this time the inhabitants of the land. I will distress them that they may find it so. Woe is me for my hurt. My wound is severe. But I say, truly this is an infirmity, and I must bear it. Whether this is Jeremiah speaking of his own inward pangs, as he sometimes speaks of, or whether he's speaking as the nation or as the city itself, talking about its woundedness, its hurt, its judgment, is not all that clear. Yes, John?
Wares, verse 17.
Yeah, your wares. Wares are your goods, the things that you have. I think wares usually refers to merchandise, things for sale. But it's possible that in this case it just means your possessions. Get your possessions together and get out of here. You inhabitants of the fortress. The fortress was the walled city of Jerusalem. He's saying, you people of Jerusalem, your safety is not to stay within those walls. They're going to be penetrated and they're going to be destroyed. You're better off getting out of the land altogether. Just put yourself in voluntary exile so you don't have to be slaughtered by this thing that's coming. Grab your stuff and go, is what he's saying. Gather your wares from the land, and so forth. Anyway, my tent, verse 20, is plundered and all my cords are broken. My children have gone from me, and they are no more. There is no one to pitch my tent anymore or set up my curtains. Probably this is God speaking about the fact that the Jews are no longer there to set up the tabernacle. Now, in Jeremiah's time, of course, the tabernacle was a thing of the past, and the temple had replaced it. But, just speaking figuratively, sometimes the tabernacle was called a house, and sometimes the temple was called a tent, just because the tabernacle and the temple were kind of counterparts of each other. They're just... He's just saying, like, the Levites used to set up the tabernacle and hang the curtains, but now there's no one left to maintain God's house. And the cords are broken, the tent is plundered. Reminiscent, isn't it, of the Shiloh event in the early chapters of 1 Samuel, where the Philistines came and captured Shiloh and destroyed it and so forth. Jeremiah has already previously, in chapter 7, compared what's going to happen in Jerusalem to what already happened in Shiloh. And maybe the language harks back to the destruction of the tabernacle at Shiloh and sees it as a type or a precursor of what's going to happen in Jerusalem. Verse 21, for the shepherds have become dull-hearted. They have not sought the Lord. Shepherds is a figure of speech that is commonly used in the prophets. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel all use this figure of speech because Israel is considered to be God's flock. God is the true shepherd, as Psalm 23 makes very clear. David said, the Lord is my shepherd. And God is called the shepherd of Israel, even back in Genesis chapter 49. The shepherd, the stone of Israel. But even though God is the ultimate shepherd, the leaders of Israel were supposed to be like under-shepherds or sheepdogs, you know, to keep the sheep from going astray. And in the service of the great shepherd, just as the elders in the church in the New Testament are called shepherds for the same reason. But they are contrasted from the chief shepherd. In 1 Peter chapter 5, the opening verses of 1 Peter 5 are addressed to the elders of the church. And Peter says, now you need to shepherd the flock, that is, feed the flock of God that is among you, taking the oversight of it, not by constraint but willingly, not for filthy lucre but of a ready mind. And he goes on to say, and when the chief shepherd shall appear, you will receive a crown, a reward from him for your efforts. So the elders are told to shepherd the flock, but they're told that they're under and answerable to the chief shepherd. Well, so also the leaders of Israel, whether it be the princes, the priests, the prophets, whoever. Whoever was giving guidance and direction to the country, they were in the position of being like shepherds over God's flock. And almost always when the prophets speak of the shepherds of Israel, they speak negatively, like the shepherds are neglecting their duties. Over, for example, in Ezekiel chapter 34, in verse 2, we see a good example of this. By the way, Ezekiel is contemporary with Jeremiah. Therefore, his statements about the shepherds are about the same shepherds Jeremiah is talking about, the same generation. But Ezekiel 34, verse 2, says, Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, thus says the Lord God to the shepherds, woe to the shepherds of Israel who feed themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flocks? Then it goes on and talks about how the shepherds have abused the flocks. Of course, Christian leaders should, of course, read these same passages and challenge their own lives by them too, because many times people do use the ministry as a means of feeding themselves rather than making it their goal to lay down their lives as a good shepherd does for the sheep and to feed the sheep. Here also, becoming in Jeremiah 10:21 against the shepherds, it says, the shepherds, or the leaders of Israel, have become dull-hearted. They have not sought the Lord. Now, obviously, if someone's going to lead the people of God in the ways of the chief shepherd, they're going to have some contact with him. They're going to have to seek him. They're going to have to know what direction he wants them to go. Therefore, they shall not prosper, and all their flocks shall be scattered. Now, I don't say that problems don't occur in churches where the leaders are seeking the Lord. I'm sure that even divisions and splits sometimes happen in the best of churches. But it seems to me like a very common phenomenon that I'm aware of, and perhaps you are too, is of churches where the leaders just aren't, they're not in the Word, they're not seeking the Lord. They've got their own agenda, or they would call it vision for the church. And I'm not saying that vision's not a good thing, but I've just come to be a little wary when I hear, you know, leaders talk about their vision for the church, because basically I've learned that that's a religious word for agenda.
Exactly.
And in most cases. And I've also come to find that when leaders have an agenda, other than just the agenda of feeding God's people and making them healthy and letting God determine what the agenda is going to be, that usually they leave off seeking the Lord and start seeking their agenda to be fulfilled, and after a while, their flocks are scattered. I've only been in this town a short time, but I've heard of several cases like that that were here prior to the time that I came, but I guess in recent history, it's part of the recent church history of McMinnville, that several churches have had serious problems. And the sheep have been scattered all over, and they're looking for new places to pasture. A lot of them have come to this church. Some of them have gone other places. But that's inevitable. When the shepherds stop seeking the Lord, there's always going to be real sheep. Well, there's going to be goats that stay with the shepherds, but there's going to be sheep that are hungry, that really want the Word. They really want God. They really want truth. And they'll wander around, and they'll leave, and they'll scatter until they find something. And that's just a phenomenon we can see all around us happening. There's starving sheep running around the United States. And I don't suppose that's... I mean, I know it's not true just of the United States. It's true of perhaps the whole Christendom. There's churches on every corner, but there's no food. There's shepherds in every pulpit, but there's no feeding going on. Or at least very little. I don't mean there's none, but I mean it's very unusual. I've visited many churches. When I lived in Bandon, I went to all the churches, and I never found one of them that I got any feeding from, and I couldn't figure out how any of those people were staying alive spiritually. In fact, I now wonder whether they were. But, I mean, I'm not anyone's judge, but I just knew that if I hadn't had the fellowship of our own school going on in on the outskirts of town, and I had to live in that town, I would have been spiritually starved to death there, just from the churches that were available. And I'm not saying there weren't some good men there and some dedicated men, but it's just rare to find real feeding going on. And the flocks get hungry, and so they scatter, looking for food elsewhere. That's what he says is going to happen to the children of Israel. Of course, in this case, in verse 21, he's talking about scattering because the shepherds are actually smitten in the judgment that comes, and the people being scattered into exile. Behold, the noise of the report has come, and a great commotion. I thought about calling our school the Great Commotion School. A great commotion out of the north country to make the cities of Judah desolate, a den of jackals. Now we have a prayer. O Lord, I know that the way of a man is not in himself. That's why it's so necessary for people to seek the Lord, which the shepherds had not done. The Lord is the one who provides the guidance needed. The way of a man is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his own steps. Mm-hmm. Therefore, he needs elders to tell him which way to go, right? No. he needs the Lord to correct him.
Unless you want to follow man.
Right. Right. I mean, Jeremiah says, I know it's not in man to direct his own way, but then who shall correct me? Lord, you correct me. But with justice, not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing. Pour out your fury on the Gentiles who do not know you, and on the families that do not call on your name. For they have eaten up Jacob and devoured him and consumed him and made his habitation desolate. We find Jeremiah somewhat of a sentimental Jew, although the message he's given from God tells him, I'm through with these people, I'm disgusted with them, don't pray for them anymore, there's no hope for them. Yet Jeremiah still has it in his heart to weep over them, to pray for them, even though God's already told him not to pray for them. He just can't stop himself from praying for them because he hates to see them plundered. But, you see, he's acknowledging the shepherds of Israel, the prophets and the priests and the rulers, have not provided leadership. They have not sought the Lord. And therefore the sheep are scattered. So he says, now, Lord, what does a sheep like me do when there's no good shepherding going on? Well, Lord, I guess you're there. You can correct me. But if you do, please do it gently. He says, don't correct me in your anger, because you could easily destroy me. You bring me to nothing. But here he's, again, the lonely man of conscience, the man who finds so little company of like mind that he wants to go out in the wilderness and lodge to just get away from it all. Now also he's bemoaning the fact that the leaders are not providing any spiritual food for him, so he just wishes, you know, that God would guide him in his life, that God will be near to him, and that God will be his shepherd and correct him and so forth. And that's what he prays there at the end. He also prays for God's judgment on the Babylonians and others that come and do damage to Israel. But that's more Jeremiah's heart than God's, in a way. I mean, God eventually did judge Babylon and others, but that's Jeremiah still being sentimental toward Jerusalem. You know, God, it's not really right that these wicked people should be able to come do this to us and judge them for it. Anyway, we've got to take our break. And when we come back to chapter 11...